Australia's Public Affairs Channel.
On behalf of PwC, I'd just like to welcome you to the McKell Institute function this afternoon. My name's Jeremy Thorpe and I lead our economics and policy practice at PwC. Just briefly, the last couple of years we've been engaging in discussions with our clients and with the community around a whole series of questions like, what would you like to change? What would you like to grow? What would you like to value? And I think the clear series of responses that we've got back from our clients, but also from the broader community, had a lot of commonality even to those three questions. And we saw a lot of the issues around infrastructure, quality of lifestyle, access to health, access to housing, and ensuring that we had an environment that was sustainable. And I think the advantage today in having Andrew come to speak to us and through the McKell Institute is many of those questions are ones that pervade public policy development, pervade politics, and they're issues that there's no simple answer to. But I'd like to welcome Peter Bentley up from the McKell Institute to introduce Andrew. But I think the McKell Institute certainly seems to have a focus on a number of those issues that we at PwC have been grappling with. And so we're interested to see how the Institute progresses that debate and today's role in it. So, Peter.
Thank you, Jeremy, very much. And can I begin by just thanking our hosts, Francis and Jeremy at PricewaterhouseCoopers for having us along here today in this magnificent venue, and thank you all for joining us today. In 2010, Andrew Leigh did a very strange thing. He decided to run for Parliament. Now, he'd made a similar decision 15 years earlier when he decided to run for a seat called Northcott on the North Shore against an unknown Liberal Party candidate by the name of Barry O'Farrell. Now, despite an 8% swing towards Andrew in that particular campaign, he failed to get the additional 24% swing required to secure the ultra-safe Liberal Party seat. But in 1995, Andrew was a university student at Sydney University. In 2010, he was a respected university professor, a position which is always ranked in the top 10 most respected professions by Australians, compared to being a Member of Parliament, which rarely gets anywhere near the top 10. Andrew West at the time actually wrote, and I think I'll just quote him verbatim, "Why Leigh, who became a full professor at one of the world's top 20 universities at just 36, has 2 degrees from Harvard University, has written 3 books, more than 50 articles for academic journals, and countless newspaper columns, and is widely regarded by his academic peers as a classic wonder kid, would bother with politics?" Now, I don't know the answer to that, but can I say, Andrew, I'm very glad that you did make that decision, because the Parliament and the government are better for having you there. Since being elected, Andrew has made a significant contribution to public debate, policy discussion on a whole range of issues, and particularly on his area of expertise, economic matters, and these are some of the subjects that he'll be speaking to us today on. And in fact, last year, despite being in Parliament, Andrew was actually awarded the Economic Society of Australia's Young Economist of the Year Award, which is given to economists to honour an Australian economist under the age of 40 who is deemed to have made a significant contribution to economic thought and knowledge. So as you can see, Andrew knows what he's talking about. So without further ado, please allow me to welcome and thank Andrew for coming and welcome him to speak to us today.
Well, Well, thanks, Peter, for an extraordinarily generous introduction and for reminding us that if I'd done a little better in 1995, I could have saved us all a bit of trouble last year. Can I, of course, begin by acknowledging we're meeting on the traditional lands of the Gadigal people and pay my respects to their elders past and present, to thank the Mackell Institute and Peter for inviting me here, and, of course, to PwC for our hosts. I used to be a part of a Toastmasters club like 20 years ago. It was PwC Toastmasters. So if I can speak in any kind of engaging way, then I guess I have PwC to thank for that. In the Pacific Ocean, off the west coast of South America, sit the Galapagos Islands. Though they straddle the equator, the pattern of ocean currents have a cooling effect, making them an ideal breeding ground for tortoises, iguanas, penguins, finches, albatrosses, and pelicans. Because the islands are volcanic, what's striking about all animal life on the Galapagos Island is that it has to have come there in two ways. It either flew there or it floated there. And they're nearly 1,000 kilometres off the coast of Ecuador. So a migrating bird, who was lucky enough to be blown off course, found an environment with few natural predators. Tortoises that floated to the Galapagos Islands found beaches perfectly suited to their natural environments. Life flourished. Looking back across Australian economic history, I'm often struck by the extent to which luck has played a similar part in our success. Politicians are sometimes reluctant to talk about luck. We prefer to focus on the things we can control than the things we can't. And yes, it's true. Chance favours the prepared mind. But I still think it's worth talking about the role that luck has played, if only to help understand the preparations we should be making. If we don't do that, we're like the Galapagos tortoise, which must have thought itself the luckiest species on Earth, until British sailors discovered the islands in the late 18th century and ate them in their thousands. Over the 2.25 centuries since European settlement, there's been half a dozen strokes of luck in Australia, and each has tangibly boosted average living standards. Let me take a moment to talk about each of these pieces of low-hanging fruit in turn. The first was plentiful land. By stealing land from Indigenous Australians, white settlers were able to be generous in handing out plenty of land to convicts and settlers alike. To them, land was so abundant it was virtually free. Abundant land became particularly productive with MacArthur's introduction of merino wool, because wool was a high-value product that could be shipped back to the markets in Britain. While Europe was land scarce in the early 1800s, Australia was labour scarce. So that meant wages were comparatively high and created huge economic opportunities. My favourite is Samuel Terry, who was transported to Australia for stealing stockings and ended his life the richest man in Australia. On his death, he owned a fifth of all mortgages in New South Wales. Free land, stolen, of course, from Indigenous Australians, provided social mobility that would have been undreamt of back in 19th century Europe. And land also provided geographic mobility. Historian John Hirst points out that early Australia was characterised by squatters who journeyed inland, bushmen who moved readily from country to city and back again. He contrasts that with the more static world of old Europe by quoting a scene from Thomas Hardy's The Mayor of Casterbridge. An English couple are parting. "I'm sorry to leave you, Nellie," said the young man with emotion, "but you see, I can't starve father, and he's out of work at Lady Day. 'Tis only 35 mile." The girl's lips quivered. 35 mile," she murmured. "Ah, 'tis enough. I shall never see ye again." Such a scene could never have been said in Australia. The second was plentiful gold. When Edward Hargreaves announced in 1851 that he had found gold in Bathurst, It started an avalanche. Over the next decade, just one decade, our population nearly tripled. Our national income almost quadrupled in a single decade as people flooded in to take advantage of Australia's mineral wealth. And the changes are felt most keenly in Victoria, whose population increased by a factor of 7 in just one decade. In 1852, Victorian Lieutenant Governor Charles Latrobe wrote, "At this time, the town and its suburbs, and the villages for several miles around Melbourne, notwithstanding the steady stream settling through it upon the road to the goldfields, are absolutely choked with the teeming population. The most extravagant rent is paid for the most indifferent accommodation, temporary or otherwise." And yet, despite those growing pains, it isn't much of an exaggeration to say that central Melbourne is largely a product of the gold rushes, which continued until the late 1800s. The Royal Exhibition Building, opened in 1880, was modelled on the Great Duomo of Florence. At the end of the 19th century, Australians enjoyed the highest standard of living in the world. The third piece of low-hanging fruit is plentiful inventions. As US economist Tyler Cohen has argued, the first half of the 20th century saw a massive upsurge in inventions. This era saw powerful motors and mass production. In transport, there were cars and aeroplanes. Communications, there were telephones and radios. In homes, domestic inventions included fridges, washing machines. In offices, typewriters, tape recorders. The combine harvester, invented in the late 19th century and widely expanded in use in the early 20th century, caused Australian grain production to soar. Might strike you as a bit odd to say that there was more global innovation in the first half of the 20th century than today. So if it does, then I want you to consider the following thought experiment. Which would you give up first, your iPad or your indoor toilet? Would you prefer to live in a world without Facebook or a world without penicillin? In the United States, where most of the world's leading-edge inventions are registered, the number of patents per researcher has actually been falling for most of the 20th century. Physicist Jonathan Huebner estimates that global innovation per person plummeted after about 1955. But for that first half of the 20th century, Australia surfed the wave of global innovation to increase our standard of living. Fourth came plentiful migrants. Prior to World War II, Australia took too few migrants. Our migration program extended those of what we called yellow skin. To our shame, we accepted just 5,000 Jewish refugees before the outbreak of World War II. But after the war, the floodgates opened. At its peak in 1949, Australia accepted in a single year 185,000 migrants into a population of 7.9 million. On today's population, that would be equivalent to a migrant inflow of more than 500,000 people. And well over half of those migrants in 1949 were from non-English speaking countries. It was an extraordinary program. Relative to the size of population, Australia's post-war migration was the largest sustained migration in the world, bigger than the US peak immigration era at the turn of the 20th century. Many went to work in the Snowy Mountains scheme, which at its peak employed 10,000 men. We played political games, visiting the European displaced persons camps in 1947. Immigration Minister Arthur Calwell reported that, quote, "Australia would be interested in the more youthful types of Baltic peoples who are capable of doing hard work. We preferred the horny hand of the sons of toil." He was particularly keen that those on the first ship were blonde-haired and blue-eyed. And so instructions were given to the Department of Immigration to select people from Latvia, Estonia, Lithuania. But for all the racial games that were played with public opinion, the simple fact remains that Australia benefited hugely from post-war migration. For once, the tyranny of distance actually worked in our favour, as people who would never ordinarily have moved thousands of kilometres from the country of their birth now wanted to flee as far as possible from the horror that had engulfed Europe. In other cases, coming to Australia was accidental. The father of a friend of mine was born in a refugee camp in Germany in 1946, the son of Polish and German refugees. He was a few years old when his family hoped to emigrate to the United States. The Red Cross moved them by train down to Naples, and he was so excited that he constantly stuck his head out the window. A piece of soot got caught in his eye, and when they got to Naples, US immigration officials were worried that he had an eye infection that might be contagious, so they refused to take the family. And then they said, "You might try the Australians," and gestured to the corner of the room. And that's why my friend, some 30 years later, was born in Queensland rather than in New Jersey. Like her, half of all Australians either have a parent who was born overseas or were themselves born overseas. The fifth form of low-hanging fruit that Australia plucked was education. In 1900, education wasn't taken particularly seriously. The bulk of schools were one-teacher schools. Compulsory attendance laws had only just been enacted in some jurisdictions, and they were poorly applied. On an average day, 3 out of every 10 children supposed to be at school were absent. Some states charged secondary school fees at the turn of the century, and in an appalling policy mistake, most states increased or reintroduced school fees when the Depression hit. Even in 1946, less than 1 out of 15 young Australians finished secondary school. Less than 1 out of 15. Hardly anyone went to university. Today, around 4 in 5 young Australians complete secondary school. Among Australians aged 25 to 34, 35% have a university degree. There's a way that economists like to summarise educational attainment in terms of years of education. For example, someone who's finished primary school has 6 years. Someone who's finished high school has 12 years. Someone with a diploma, 13 years. Someone with a university degree, 15 years. On that measure, the average number of years of education among the working age population rose from just an average of 7 years in 1900 to 9 years in 1950 to 13 years in 1990. And over the past 20 years, it's increased, but just modestly. Rising education is low-hanging fruit because education has such a huge payoff. On average, just one more year of education boosts average earnings every year in your life by 10%. And there's no evidence that the economic returns to education have declined as attainment has gone up. We also have good evidence that education pays off in non-economic ways. Better educated people tend to be healthier, happier, less likely to commit crimes, more likely to be engaged in civic activities. The sixth form of low-hanging fruit is the 21st century mining boom. There's been so much ink spilled on this topic that I'm not going to say much today. For reasons entirely outside the control of our miners, world commodity prices have tripled in the past decade. The ratio of the prices of the things we sell to the prices of the things we buy have reached a 140-year high last year. Urbanising China and India need steel to make their skyscrapers. And Australia happens to be the world's biggest producer of iron ore and a major producer of coking coal. At present, we export iron ore at the rate of 4 tonnes every second. Treasury official David Gruen recently noted, "The mining and mining-related sectors, which together account for about 20% of the economy, were expected to contribute more than two-thirds of real GDP growth in 2011-12. while the 70% of the economy not directly benefiting from the resources boom was expected to contribute less than a third. Therefore, while the 2011-12 budget forecasts imply quite good aggregate real GDP growth, around 70% of the economy is expected to grow around 1%. And yet, compared to the 1970s terms of trade shock, the benefits of this mining boom are flowing more broadly through the economy. Inflation's low, unemployment has dropped during the mining boom, and even the dispersion of unemployment across labour markets in Australia has fallen. Moving from the old royalty regime to a profits-based mining tax means that when prices rise, tax revenue goes up too. In an environment where parts of the non-mining sector are suffering from Dutch disease, this strikes me as a pretty reasonable approach. So Australia picked six pieces of low-hanging fruit: plentiful land, the 19th century gold rush, abundant inventions, post-war migration, mass education, and the current mining boom. They weren't all dumb luck. We also made some good policy decisions along the way. In the post-war era, Australia benefited greatly from far-sighted economic reforms, such as the scrapping of White Australia, the HECS-funded expansion of universities, floating the dollar, tearing down the tariff wall, enterprise bargaining, and replacing a patchwork of sales taxes with the GST. The question is, what next? How do we make sure our nation continues to prosper economically? In my view, the only way of ensuring that Australia continues to enjoy rising living standards is to find ways of raising our productivity. To most economists, the relationship between productivity and growth is as natural as the link between clouds and rainfall. We regard productivity, producing more output for the same inputs, as the main driver of long-run growth. But in my experience, that's not the way some of my non-economist friends regard productivity. I might have been scarred by a bad boss who said, "You should work smarter," when really what the boss meant was, "You should work harder." So some of my friends hear the word productivity and immediately feel the hackles start to raise at the back of their necks. There's nothing perverse in the idea of productivity. Productivity simply means being able to do tasks more effectively. In this sense, we've all become more productive over our lives. As children, we learn to become better readers. We learn to absorb more information in the same amount of time. When we moved into our own homes for the first time, we quickly became better at doing household chores. After we've spent a decade in the workforce, most of us make fewer mistakes than we made when we were in our first year of the job. Productivity growth was frankly lousy in the 2000s, but we can learn something from the previous decade. During the 1990s, Australia managed to double the rate of productivity growth. According to the PC's Dean Parham, there were three main drivers of that increase: 50% to having a more open economy, 30% to more research and development, and 20% to the IT revolution. So today, I think the two big productivity challenges for Australia are to keep our economy open to the world and to boost the quality of our education system. Australia has to pursue openness because our future lies with economic engagement with the world. In terms of migration, Australia benefits when new migrants bring their ideas. But we also benefit when people born in Australia spend time overseas and then return, as I'm sure many of you have done. For the brief period where I headed the economics program at the Research School of Social Sciences, I remember noticing that only one of the approximately 30 researchers was born and had studied in Australia. Everyone else was either foreign-born or Australian-born but completed their PhD overseas. In terms of trade, Australia needs to continue to pursue open markets internationally. Just as we benefited from taking the rocks out of our own harbours, we need to encourage others to do likewise. In the 1980s, we established the Cairns Group of Agricultural Free Trading Nations. In the 1990s, we set up the APEC Leaders Meetings. Now, because momentum stalled in the consensus-based World Trade Organisations, Julia Gillard and Craig Emerson are working on a new pathway to progress the Doha Round, called the Trans-Pacific Partnership. It's a stepping stone to the APEC goal of a free trade area in the Asia-Pacific. The idea with the Trans-Pacific Partnership is it allows other countries to bolt on as free traders at a later date. We also need to be honest with Australians about foreign investment. At least one National Party senator has claimed that there's been an exponential increase in agricultural foreign investment, but the facts show otherwise. Between 1984 and 2010, the area of Australian farmland that is foreign-owned rose from 5.9% to 6%. Rural Australians enjoy more jobs and better pay as a result of foreign investment, just as they've done since CSR helped establish our sugar industry in 1855. The other big productivity challenge is to boost the performance of Australia's educational institutions, and particularly our schools. In research that I did with Chris Ryan, we found that Australia's literacy and numeracy scores had failed to improve from the 1960s to the 2000s. Since then, Australia's scores on the international PISA test have actually fallen. At the same time, the academic aptitude of new teachers relative to their classmates when they were in school has declined. One possible reason for that is Australia chose to focus on reducing class sizes rather than attracting the best teacher. The story of education over the past quarter century is class sizes were cut by about 10%, and at the same time teacher salaries relative to professional salaries declined by about 10%. So I said earlier that increasing the quantity of education was low-hanging fruit. By contrast, increasing the quality of education is fruit that's on a slightly higher branch. But it's a particularly attractive goal if we can get there, because it doesn't involve the same sacrifice. More time in school necessarily means less time doing other things. But raising the quality of education means packing more learning into every year. We've learned anything from the economics of education over the past few decades, it's that the relationship between spending and outcomes is extremely weak. You can see this in the trend over time in Australia, where spending has risen, but test scores have flatlined. Or you can see it if you use the MySchool data to compare spending and results across schools. More money creates the potential for improvement, but the relationship is far from automatic. So I think the most interesting questions in education are about how the money is spent. Among the reforms that Peter Garrett are pursuing in this area are principal autonomy through the Empowering Local Schools program, trades training centres to teach new skills and, perhaps more importantly, to boost retention, and performance pay to reward the best teachers. I've got a particular interest in performance pay, having given a keynote address at an Economics of Education conference in Munich last year, which gave me a chance to look right across the literature on what we know about the economics and the politics of merit pay. And from reading all that literature, I came to the conclusion that anyone who says that merit pay always works, or that it never works, hasn't spent enough time engaging with what we know. There's clearly merit pay models for teachers that are successful. There's clearly merit pay models for teachers that are unsuccessful. And the challenge is to build the evidence base to a point where we can confidently tell the difference. Writer George Megalogenis describes populist politicians who oppose economic reform as playing with the kryptonite. Both sides of Australian politics have to take our share for populist policies. In the 1980s, 1990s, there were some, including the current Leader of the Opposition, who, in those decades, opposed the float of the dollar. And yet, without a floating dollar acting as a shock absorber to international events, it's easy to imagine that the Asian financial crisis, the US tech wreck, or the current mining boom could have had disastrous impacts on the domestic economy. The same can be said of Labor's flirtation with populism in the 1990s. In the 1998 election campaign, we promised to abolish the Productivity Commission, the very same body that has now done the essential groundwork for a national disability insurance scheme. In 1999, we also opposed the Goods and Services Tax, a reform that Paul Keating had supported the previous decade. I just can't imagine Labor now promising to go to an election to untax services and reinstate the patchwork of sales taxes that existed in that era. We can also see more than a hint of populism in Tony Abbott's campaign against market-based mechanisms in areas such as water buybacks and the Murray-Darling Basin, and a price on carbon pollution. And yet we shouldn't be surprised that these campaigns find receptive ears. In public life, it's always been easier to scare people than honestly inform them. It's just that most of us choose not to walk the fear-mongering road. Today, animal life on the Galapagos Islands is thriving again. 3 decades after receiving World Heritage listing, the World Heritage Committee has removed the Galapagos Islands from its list of precious sites endangered by environmental threats or overuse. This didn't happen by chance. It was due to the hard work of the Park Service, the Charles Darwin Foundation, and the Ecuadorian government. Galapagos Islands still have invasive species, but there's good programs in place to manage them. After a lucky start, nature on the Galapagos Islands now thrives because of good management and planning with an eye to the future. Perhaps there's a lesson in that for the lucky country too. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Andrew. Andrew's happy to take some questions from the audience, and I think we've got a roving mic going around, so if anyone does have any questions either on his speech or I'm sure he's happy to take questions on politics and economics in general, please put up your hand. Might go to Chris over here.
Andrew, how do you put all that together and create a Labor agenda? Labor's sitting at 30% in the polls, and one of the reasons probably is because people don't quite know what Labor stands for. So how do you meld all that stuff together and create a clear and distinct Labor agenda based on what you said?
Chris, I think there's hints for me. If you want to know what it stands for, you look at the Labor First speeches. And there's two things that mark out a Labor First speech from a Coalition First speech. First of all, there's almost always a migration story. A Labor MP will either tell a story of how they came from overseas, how their family came from overseas, how their family's been touched by migration. There's something about multicultural Australia with its ability to create one of the most extraordinary migration experiments in the world that strikes deep at the Labor core. And the other story you'll get is an education story. Coalition MPs in their first speeches don't do it as much. Labor MPs do it a lot. They'll tell a tale about how education made a difference in their lives, how their parents got a chance to attend university thanks to Commonwealth scholarships or free education. So there is that Labor core and that sort of melding, I guess, of a multicultural agenda, but also what I would regard as a modern productivity market-based agenda of education is where I would see the Labor story flying from. But also curious on your views on this as well, if that, and those of others.
Again,
You've been deprived of the mic.
Thank you very much. My name is Laurie Piercy. I'm CEO of the Australia China Business Council and also a director of the McGill Institute. I thought that was a very, very fascinating presentation, and I think it's wonderful to see a Labor Member of Parliament out there with a really fascinating narrative for the future of our country. A point followed by a question. As part of my travel up into China on a fairly regular basis, I see what our OECD competitors are up to in the market. England, for example, or the United Kingdom, trades about $13 billion a year with China. None of that iron ore, none of it coke and coal, as we know. Yet the UK's diplomatic footprint and their trade and investment promotion footprint in China is absolutely streets ahead of ours. And I think that as an economy, we can be doing more, because at the end of the day, rocks will always sell themselves. And my question is, as an economist, but also as a member of a Labour government, we've seen a lot recently about the potential unionisation of the Pilbara. I wonder what you think that might do for productivity, and what aspects do you think are driving up what a unionisation of the Pilbara would mean for productivity, and what it would also mean for the Labour bill for the miners in the Pilbara. Thank you very much.
So, two great questions, I think, fairly distinct. In terms of our engagement with China, this is part of the reason why we commissioned the Asian Century Review from Ken Henry. And I suspect some of that will look at effective trade promotion. There is a kind of scorched earth economist's view that everything sells itself and you don't need Austrade. I don't support that view. I think there is, where you've got cultural barriers, there is a role for helping firms break through, and for following on the coattails of, say, the Brisbane architectural firm, which is now designing a large number of the sporting facilities in China. So that we have great successes outside the mining sector. In terms of the impact on the Pilbara, I think a lot of this has been overplayed. If you can simply just look at labour costs within the mining sector, and you find that labour costs are a small share of total costs. There is no more capital-intensive industry than mining. So if you were thinking about an industry that would be significantly affected by unionisation, the last one you would come to is Australia's most capital-intensive industry. And I don't know of systematic evidence suggesting that unionisation decreases productivity. In other contexts, unions will raise skills, they'll help resolve disputes quickly, they'll make sure that management has a conduit through to workers to get information out. All of those are valuable roles unions have played through the Australian story, and high unionisation, high productivity are happy bedfellows.
What I suppose has been lost, sort of falling productivity over the Howard period, much of it due to, as you say, high capital intensity in mining and the sort of, the position of the mining industry in the economy. We seem to have lost the capacity to focus on workplace productivity and what capacity there is in terms of productivity at the industrial level. I understand you're talking more broadly about the role of education and health and all those sorts of things in terms of national productivity. But where do you think the future direction is in terms of industrial relations and productivity beyond the narrow debate our friends in the Business Council are running? I just say one small thing about our experience with workplace productivity. In Australian manufacturing, the best assessment I saw of the level of capacity of Australian manufacturing managers showed that they were behind the OECD benchmark in all of the 14 categories that they were being measured on. That's a critical issue in terms of the future of productivity in our industries. So I just wondered if you had any reflections about the intersection of IR and productivity.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is, you're right, Tim, about thinking of broadening out the debate between a sort of how do we slice up the pie to how do we make firms work better. At the end of the day, productivity is something that businesses do. Businesses manage to find smarter ways of organising their enterprise, and smarter managers are more likely to find those solutions. This was an issue that everyone was screaming about in the early 80s. You had a whole lot of reports about how bad the quality of Australian management was. I haven't seen very much around at the moment, just because I don't think we're collecting some of the good data that was around. It's kind of an academic economist point, I guess, but the old AWERS survey, I think, was really useful in terms of better understanding why certain enterprises worked better than others, and so getting more data on that would be useful. Management training is also less prevalent here than it is in, say, the US, and you know, there might be little snippets of things we want to import from the US, and ongoing management training could be one of those.
We'll go to Ben Keneally. Andrew, again, thanks for the presentation. I think if I could make a suggestion that goes back to Chris's question about narrative, I think whenever we've been successful as a Labor Party talking about productivity, we've always married it to the twin concept of distribution as well, distributional outputs. And the conservative point of view is that you increase productivity and naturally, by magic, it turns into higher wages for all, you know, for all, and it turns into better outcomes. And we know that politically that's not always true. And that in fact you need to that productivity brings with it the opportunity for redistribution, because it's less of a challenge to recut the cake. But also, it's essential that is driven by government. The government plays a role in ensuring that the benefits of productivity do flow to the rest of the community. And I wonder whether a thought on whether we're communicating enough about the distribution side.
Yeah. No, Ben, it's a great question. I was here in Sydney a couple of weeks ago at another institute, which can't be named in these surroundings, speaking about the issue of inequality. And so I kind of deliberately sliced out any discussion of the distribution issues here. As you say, there's two ways to think about it. First of all, if you boost education, boost openness, what does that do to distribution? Secondly, if it makes the pie larger, can you use some of that to redistribute? My sense is that education definitely makes us a more equal country. I think of, you know, if you ask me my kind of back of the envelopes, what explains inequality? It's a race between technology and education. Periods where education stagnates and you have massive tech advances, the gap between rich and poor widens. Periods in which you have faster improvements in education, compulsory schooling laws, cheaper university, more tech training, that narrows the gap between rich and poor. So education is it's a growth policy and it's an equaliser, so efficiency and equity. Openness, I suspect, is a bit of a wash. So greater openness brings the import challenges from countries that tend to have lower wages than ours, so that threatens the bottom half of the income distribution. It also makes stuff cheaper, though. So the tariffs currently being paid are on cars and clothes. The poor spend more of their income on clothing and footwear than the rich do. So any reduction in those tariffs would be progressive. Any reduction in car tariffs would probably be slightly regressive. In the end, you're not talking about massive impacts here, because the consumer effects and the producer effects are probably fairly small. And both of them give you more income to, say, put in place a national disability insurance scheme to increase family payments to those at the bottom of the distribution, to do things people have been calling on, like raising New Start. All of those things are more possible if the economy is bigger.
G'day, Andrew. Sean Mackin. A bit of a hard question, I guess, in some respects to answer, but to what extent do you think the decline in productivity over the last half decade or decade or so, we put down to three things? Tim mentioned the decline in productivity in the mines as the investment boom has taken off. Australia and every sector almost has just experienced the largest drought, which has seen a dramatic decline in the productivity of agricultural land. And also with the building, the education revolution, and the bashing up of a few Indian students in our education sector, has seen a massive decline in our productivity in the education sector. Do those three things alone account for that decline in productivity? And if so, is there really a problem?
So let me go through those three. The drought is an early noughties story. By the late noughties, the drought has broken. So you ought to see that a little bit in agricultural productivity, but agriculture is only a tenth of the economy and the drought's over. So that doesn't seem massive to me. Mining being in the investment phase has certainly got to matter. So mining's in the phase where they're building a lot of infrastructure relative to the amount that they're digging out. So that's got to drive down measured productivity. It's got to be important. But again, we're talking about a sector that is that's a fifth of the economy. What was your third factor there, Sean?
The massive investment in capital in the public education,
into education. So the thing I worry most about education and healthcare is that we're not measuring productivity very well. So that, say, the advent of the ability now to save babies who are born at week 25 rather than week 28 just isn't... That's a massive improvement in the performance of our healthcare system. It's not picked up particularly well in statistics. So we might be... We might not be measuring those productivity increases in the services economy as well as we would otherwise. But I do also think, just in general, that the lack of investment in education over the Howard years was a problem. And particularly, you know, the thing that always bugged me about Howard government ministers was they would give different advice to poor kids than they'd give to their own kids. So they would give advice to poor kids that said, you know, you shouldn't finish school if you don't feel you ought to. Don't take seriously all this talk about universities. Trades are perfectly fine. And then for their own kids, they're always telling them to go to university. You don't actually hear that if you listen to American politicians, Barack Obama, George Bush, Bill Clinton, doesn't matter. They're all going to tell poor kids, strive for as much education as you can get. And I think that's got to be the right message, given how fast technology is advancing. So it's partly an advocacy message as well as an investment one.
Andrew, Jenny McAllister. I just wanted to follow on, I guess, about questions of equity in the education system. And, you know, we know that you made quoted some statistics about our overall levels of attainment not really improving in the way that we'd like. But we also see in some of those statistics a very high variation in performance, which seems quite strongly associated with class in this country. I guess I'm just wondering how you see a pathway out of a situation where, particularly in our metropolitan cities, wealthy children are educated in a cohort together and create a, one suspects, a mutually reinforcing set of expectations for one another about where they'll land in the world. And less well-off children are educated together and, I suspect, create the same thing. How do you think that's... How do you see that unfolding, I guess, post-Gonski?
So I... That question, I think you're more concerned about peers and I would be more concerned about teachers. My read of the kind of peer, what education economists call the peer effects literature, is that the ability of smart kids to influence the other kids, to improve the outcomes of the other kids in their class, is fairly modest. And you know, this accords with my kind of introspection that if you have a really smart kid in the class, then they can only really help out one or two kids at a time. To the extent that peer effects matter, they're actually, in terms of disruptive kids, who simply by shouting out can affect the educational outcomes of 25 peers simultaneously. But in terms of smart kids improving outcomes of other kids, it doesn't look like that's massive from what I've read. But we do have a distribution of teachers issue. So if you look across public schools in Australia and you ask them, have you had difficulty filling vacancies, low SES schools are 2-3 times as likely to say that they have had real difficulties filling vacancies. That's not that surprising. We've got a flat salary schedule. You get paid the same for teaching a rich kid as you do for teaching a poor kid in the public system. And so it's just, you can see it from the data, that teachers are sorting towards starting their career teaching poor kids and finishing their career teaching rich kids. Some are exceptions to that, but what I've told you is the norm. And that's the opposite to what a policy of equality of opportunity would tell you you want. You want great teachers teaching poor kids. And our current policy settings haven't always ensured that.
And to ensure that time doesn't get away, we'll just take two final very quick questions. One here and then...
My name is Fred Allen Andrew. There was a question asked earlier about redistribution, and the point on which I request your observations is related, but it's not the same. Now, my understanding is that there is a fairly acute shortage of tax revenue, both at the federal and at the state level. There's a shortage of revenue to the government. And against that context, it seems inevitable that tax rates must be increased, and that increase could be a number of taxes. But if one were to argue that what should be increased is the marginal tax rate of income tax, applicable not only to the individuals but also other entities, for this reason, because Australia has quite a number of taxes, such as the GST, both federal, state, and local government, which are imposed not on ability to pay. GST is a good example. Even at the local level, council rates is not a tax based on ability to pay. So too, those taxes really make the tax system quite substantially regressive. In order to remedy that regressivity, the marginal tax rate of income tax must be increased. And if that were to be suggested, one would counter that quite easily by saying that it would impede productivity, which is something that you spoke of extensively. So I would like you to say whether that is in fact the case. Would a possible increase in the marginal rate of income tax, would it substantially impede productivity?
So the question was about the relationship between taxes and productivity. My sense is that there may be modest effects, but I don't think there are significant effects of taxes on productivity. Higher taxes cause people to work fewer hours, and it's possible that, you know, if I halved the number of hours each of you could work, your productivity would actually go up. So taxes can reduce output, but they don't reduce productivity, which you think of as kind of the efficiency of performance. In the end, all taxes are only paid by three sources: land, labour, or capital. And so I certainly take seriously Ken Henry's argument that if you want progressivity, you should do that through the income tax, rather than trying to bolt on progressivity through other taxes. So I think you just end up in a muddle if you try and make every tax progressive. The best thing to do is have taxes like corporate taxes, consumption taxes, environmental taxes, which operate across the board, and then get your progressivity back through the income tax. That's a standard way of running things.
Lucky last, Andrew. Blake Briggs, Financial Services Council. The financial services sector actually had quite strong productivity growth over the last 10 years.
Yes.
And we did that without tariffs or protectionism, to make that point. We got on a lot of the reforms that came through from government in the 90s. My next question is that what's quite important in our view is the Johnson Review into Australia Financial Services Centre and implementing that review in full. What are your views on it, and where do you think we go to from here?
So, Blake, I don't have strong views on financial sector reforms in general. I mean, the one thing that you notice out of finance sector jobs is they tend to be good jobs. They tend to pay above the average. In fact, Paul Krugman makes the argument that in the US they pay much too much above the average, and that they're the principal contributor to inequality. But it's clear that the growth of the finance sector will continue. Our challenge is going to be how Australia fits into the context of an Asia Pacific where plenty of other countries are keen to establish finance hubs. But I think the Chi-X makes a lot of sense. I think allowing the renminbi to be traded in Australia, I think, is also an important step. And I know that some of the issues through the Henry Review are being explored as well. We want to consider Australia as a finance sector hub is in some sense part of a bigger conversation about what is Australia's role in Asia and being a services hub in general, I think, makes a lot of sense. That might not just be finance. That could be education, could be design as well. Those are things that Australia is particularly well pitched towards.
And I've been assured through a series of hand gestures that this final question will be very short and sweet. So.
I don't like them, RTVU. Andrew, thank you for that today. And I might disclose at the start here a number of conflicting positions that I'm in. I'm clearly a trade unionist. I'm a member of the New South Wales Labor Policy Education Commission, and my mum's also a teacher, so I get ear-bashed on the Teachers Federation's view on things. I want to ask specifically how the government or how you would propose to bring on board the conflicting views, trade unions, teachers, students, parents, in terms of ensuring, because I agree with you that increased productivity in education will see better outcomes. How are you going to propose, given that the government's had a little bit of difficulty getting people heading in the same direction, to do just that with the conflicting views? And this is definitely something that is important to me as a member of the Education Commission.
Education is heavily politically charged. My first political acts was to join a rally against Terry Metherill's class size freeze. I'm not sure, given what I've just said about class size, whether that was a good thing to be doing. I suspect I would not join that rally today, but it inspires strong passions, as it should. It's important. I think we need to raise the evidence base in education. You look at the evidence base we have in an area like medicine or even an area like health policy, and it just makes the standard of evidence in education look as though it's a generation behind. So many education debates are really driven based on theory rather than strong, rigorous outcomes. One of the things that the Obama administration has tried to do is race to the top, which is basically the federal government in the US putting out a large pool of money for states to run high-quality evaluations. So that encourages states to work out what works in education. And it turns out you get a whole lot of surprises when you do that. But you then have an evidence base from which you can build on which you can build a political consensus.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Ben.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Andrew, for your address. Whenever we speak of the lucky country, it always reminds me of that old golf saying, you know, the more I practice, the luckier I get. And while Andrew today has very aptly explained a whole range of the breaks that we as a nation have had over the last 200 years, I think his focus on productivity and on some of the economic reforms that we need in order to continue that luck are very timely, and I'm sure he and others will be working in our nation's capital to deliver that for all of us. Thank you all for attending today. I'd like to thank again PricewaterhouseCoopers for hosting us in this magnificent venue. Tea and coffee's being distributed, and thanks again for coming along and joining us today.